Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from North Rim Bank, supporting economic and business reporting across the state on Alaska Public Media. NorthRimBank.com.
Welcome to Alto Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tordai. Today, I'm joined by author Mary Beth Holloman to discuss her new book, Tender Gravity, and how her life in the outdoors influences her writing. Stay tuned for Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Welcome to the show, Mary Beth.
Thanks, Paul. Happy to be here.
Let's start, Mary Beth, with your Alaska origins story.
Sure, Paul. So I've lived in Alaska for 35 years now. I grew up in Asheville, North Carolina. So I grew up in the mountains. I've always loved mountains. When I was young, I wanted to live somewhere where the mountains and the sea were close to each other, closer than in North Carolina. And so when I, after college, my boyfriend and I were traveling around the country and stopping and working, and we're in Tucson, and I discovered in a magazine like an ad for summer jobs in Alaska, working in Denali, I think. And so we contacted them and they said, hey, we have a job for you in Portage. So we drove in our truck camper up to Alaska and lived by the train tracks in Portage that first summer, selling tickets on the train.
Huh.
And that was my first experience in Alaska. And there are the mountains falling into the sea. It just blew my mind, and I really just fell in love right away. That first summer, we also went out in the Sound, first in a little 15-foot Avon that we had to fix all the holes in first before we went out. And then later we got into kayaks, Prince William Sound Kayak Center. Perry and Lois were the first ones to put me in a kayak, and I thank them every day since, because it's just a wonderful way to experience that amazing place. So after the first summer, we ended up just staying. And after a while, my family stopped asking me when I was coming home.
So let's go to the Sound. Your first book was The Heart of the Sound. But did you talk about writing and how you got into writing and that process of your as a writer?
Yeah. So my undergraduate degree is actually in environmental studies from UNC in Chapel Hill. But soon after that, I worked in policy and science for a while and thought that, well, if scientists could just convey their information to policymakers, that everything would get fixed. Mm-hmm. And so soon enough, I realized that there was more to it than that. And I realized that what had affected me and informed my view of the world was not just being out in the natural world, but also some writers like Edward Abbey, Rachel Carson, Henry David Thoreau. You know, we know all these amazing writers. And so I thought, well, maybe I should start writing then. And so at first I was just writing articles, and then came to Alaska and wanted to do more creative writing. I started in the MFA program at University of Alaska Anchorage and was going to write about the Copper River Delta. I spent some time there. And then the oil spill happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I started writing about. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. I was naive, again, that this could even potentially happen in Prince William Sound. I guess I knew those oil tankers were crossing the Sound, you know, far away from the part of the Sound that I spent time in, but I just had no idea that a tragedy of that magnitude could happen and that people could be so unprepared to deal with it. So anyhow, I was in the MFA program. I started writing essays about it. Many of those essays, you know, some got published. And then later I thought about putting them together into a book. So the book came together first as essays that I was writing. And then later I, you know, created the full narrative of the book.
And that was The Heart of the Sound, and that was published in 2004, right?
Yes.
Because we had a book release together.
That's
at
right.
APU.
Yes.
Yep. So
yeah.
I was telling
your
that story today.
Book.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The Sound was one connection of a place. What are some of the other places that you've connected with?
Denali. Mm-hmm. It's an incredible place, and that first summer after selling tickets in Portage, we spent the last few weeks that September working at the gift shop in Denali. I've spent a lot of time in Denali over the years and was fortunate enough to have an artist residency there where I stayed in the cabin that the Murrays lived in when they were living in the park and studying the wolves and the sheep. And it's just such a grand landscape. Other places, Southeast Alaska, I've had some incredible kayak trips down there and in some of those wilderness areas. I've done a little bit in the Arctic, some Arctic river trips that the Noatak River, which was an amazing experience of being so away from human sound, sight for such a long period of time, which I think is so rare for us now to be able to have that experience.
That that drainage, I believe, is one of the longest protected drainages in North America, at least. It's an amazing place.
Right. It really is.
And so let's go back to the sound. You made this connection, and then this oil spill, which affected all of us who love the sound and made a living or, people have been there for thousands of years. What were some of your reactions to that spill? Obviously very emotional. and you wrote. What else did you do?
Oh, gosh.
To deal with that loss, in a way.
Yeah, so that first spring and summer, I was frantic, along with thousands of other people, to try to do something to fix it somehow. I went to Homer and went out on a boat to try to catch oiled mirrors. And we just spent a full day driving around in this boat. You know, wonderful people trying their best, but such a futile effort. I think we got one bird. most of them we just chased away. It was so heartbreaking. I went to Seward and cleaned oiled sea otters for a while. And that was also a very heartbreaking experience where, again, just wondering, like, what can we do? Like, how can we fix this? And then the last thing I did was I spent a couple weeks on Perry Island in the Sound. And that project was just Kelly Weaverling from Cordova got funding to do this project where we were just witnessing. Mm-hmm. We were just there and we were just recording everything we saw, the wildlife we saw, the boats going by, the oil on the water, the booms, everything. And to me, that seemed the most useful. Mm-hmm. Because we weren't trying to, you know, sometimes, what is the, you know, the oath that doctors take first, do no more harm. It's really hard to do that sometimes when you're trying to fix something. So I did a lot and in the end realized that once the oil's in the water, there's very little we can do. So what we need to do is keep it from getting in the water.
That's... seems to be a little bit of human nature is we want to fix things, jump in and fix things, and usually we're reacting versus being proactive.
Yeah.
Now, mm-hmm. you and I've known each other for a while, and we've been on a few advocacy, just little events and organizations. And so I would think that at some point that's where you went. You went to advocacy to try to prevent things. Is that fair?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I did a lot of writing, op-eds, that kind of thing, a lot of petitions, a lot of rallies, letter writing to Congress people, just trying to promote change, trying to, you know, wake people up and create some change. It's so hard to do. For example, another one of my books, Among Wolves, we started a petition to get the governor of Alaska to create a buffer for Denali's wolves who spend a lot of time in this stampede area in the winter and were really getting nailed when they would leave the wilderness area of the park and go on to state land. And I think we got 450,000 people to sign this petition.
Wow.
And still, it didn't happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are long slogs that make change like that.
They are.
For sure. Yeah. So the heart of the sound was some essays, somewhat biographical in nature, would you say?
Yes. Yeah. It's a memoir.
Yep.
Yeah. Of my first 15 years in Alaska.
Yeah. Very, very touching book. And so what was your next project?
After The Heart of the Sound, I co-edited an anthology called Cross Currents North, Alaskans on the Environment. My co-editor is Anne Corre, an amazing poet and fiction writer in Alaska. And she and I teamed up. She was the poetry editor and I was the essay editor. And we collected stories from Alaskan writers. And our idea with this book was to share stories and to create a stronger sense of Alaskans caring for their environment, that we really do, and that we can do this. And so that was my next book project after that. It was Cross Currents North.
So again, connected with place.
Absolutely.
And nature. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we go to Gordon Haber, is that correct? Yeah, talk about your connection with him. And
so Gordon Haber studied wolves in Denali for 43 years before he was killed in his research plane crash in 2009 in the mountains in Denali. And I had known of him for a very long time. I remember coming actually to APU and hearing him talk for the first time and being so impressed not only with his knowledge of wolves, but his passion for his study subject. He didn't have that sort of dry, you know, detached manner. Which I really appreciate, because I think most people, when they, you know, most biologists, when they decide to go study murrelets or brown bears or whatever their subject matter is, they start because they're curious and interested and there's a passion. And he never lost it. So he always struck me as someone who was pretty amazing. And then later, he and my husband, Rick Steiner, became friends, mainly through advocacy, pushing for this Denali buffer. And so then when he, and you know, I'd be in touch with him when we'd go to Denali, I'd just email him or call him and say, hey, where have you been seeing wolves? It was kind of cool to, you know, have that inside track.
Yeah.
and he always had such great stories because he spent thousands of hours just watching wolves in the wild.
Yeah.
So when he died, we had a memorial service and, you know, his longtime pilot was there, people that had known him for a long time. And I said, you know, we should get all of his writings together and make a book, because he had had a blog, he'd had scientific articles, he had boxes full of Write in the Rain pads filled with all these notes. He had, and so many photographs. So I thought it'd be a collaborative effort, but, you know, it ended up just being me. And I got permission from his family to, you know, use all of his materials. And Rick helped me with that. Rick sorted through all of his materials to give to the archives here at the library. And I put together a book that's partly my writing about his work and him. It's partly vignettes of people's stories of time that they spent with him out there watching wolves. And it's partly, mostly, it's his own writing about what he learned about wolves.
I thought it was a very powerful book about an individual and their passion to help another species out. I was very impressed with it. So,
yeah.
And then we get to Tender Gravity, is that right? What we're here to talk about today. But before we get into that a little bit, I want to ask you, what about this connection with nature and places and right now? When you go, we've been out together in the sound and little sort of parallel trips, basically. When I go out, everybody sees different things and experiences different things. How are you seeing, experiencing things through the writer's lens?
Well, I think being a writer reminds me to pay attention all the time. And that's one of the things that I love about poetry. I read poetry long before I tried writing it. And poetry really gets to the essence. You can't spend very many words getting down what you need to say. So being in the natural world, I try to keep all my senses open. And I think that we all do that anyhow. You know, we this sense of awe can come pretty easily when you're sitting in front of a tidewater glacier and it lets loose a big chunk of ice falling into the water right in front of you. Those moments are kind of what I live for. So I think as a writer, I'm thinking in terms of how can I take this experience and share it with other people through the written word, which is my medium.
Yeah, yeah. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Tordock. I have in the studio with me Mary Beth Holloman, who's the author of her recently published book, Tender Gravity, of a collection of poems that she's written. I want to, you mentioned the glaciers, and the glaciers are featured in some of the poems. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting was this sort of, dichotomy of losing something, a glacier, at the same time of that loss in itself being beautiful.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, there's a quote by Rainer Maria Rilke, and he talks about beauty and terror and how they're kind of two sides of the same coin. There's lots of writers that have spoken to this, you know, the idea that you can't have grief without joy. And so I do think a lot about that, especially now when I'm watching my glaciers leave, you know. Yeah. And I call them mine because, you know, Neliwan, for example, Neliwan Fjord, and the glaciers that I've known now for 35 years, I feel a connection to them. I feel like I know them, and I'm watching them leave. And every time I go out there, they're changed.
Yeah.
So, glaciers are... I feel like they have personalities.
I was just going to say that, yeah.
They really do. And this last summer, I had the great good fortune to finally go to Russell Fjord Wilderness outside of Yakutat. It was an artist residency through the Voices of the Wilderness program, which is an incredible program of sending artists into public lands in Alaska. And I wanted to go there because I'd heard about the Hubbard Glacier, and I really wanted to see it, the way that it had closed off Russell Fjord a couple times, and to see a glacier that's actually advancing.
Mm-hmm.
So I did get to do that. We boated up to the face of it and got really close, and it was very active, and we could see the narrow opening between the glacier and the land that would close off, you know, sometimes close off Russell Fjord. Could feel the current almost trying to suck us into Russell Fjord, too. It was quite exciting.
Yeah.
And it felt so good to be around a glacier that wasn't leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that there's all kinds of hydrology reasons for the way it's advancing, and it's very rare, but it just gave me such solace to be sitting there in front of that one, which is so incredibly active.
Yeah. Yeah, I love the idea of a glacier. Usually, you know, animals, maybe plants have been alive, but to have this bunch of ice, it's more than that, but primarily snow and ice, having this personality of not only a little seasonal, but also daily changes and rhythms and noises, and you know, the idea of a glacier speaking to us. It's a little anthropological license there, but it does happen. It's pretty neat thing. It makes that connection to them that everybody appreciates.
Yeah, glaciers and rocks too. A lot of my poems, you know, are about rocks, stones, cliffs, and I do feel like the earth does speak in so many ways that we only know a little bit of it. And sometimes when I hear about an indigenous people's story about glaciers, for example, there's a lot more there, and they know it.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
they're not afraid to talk about glaciers speaking to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, over the years, I used to shy away from anthropomorphizing, but anymore I've just thought, you know what, that's just a block we don't need to have. I mean, especially I'm a writer.
Yeah. Like,
if I was a scientist, maybe I'd have to be more careful. But I just feel that that the Earth does speak to us in so many ways, and that the more that we open to it, and the more that we try to hear it, and respond to what we're hearing, the better off everybody's going to be. All the humans, all the other species, the glaciers, the stones, everybody.
Yeah. Why not? Do you have something to read for us from the book?
Sure. I guess I could read it. Well, let's see. You want me to read a rock poem?
Sure.
Okay.
Yes. Let's hear about rocks. Okay. I like this one. Yeah.
Okay. So this one, rock poem. So in this poem, it was another artist residency in the Tracy Orme Ford's Terror Wilderness in Southeast Alaska. And I'm sitting on some rocks with a ranger and looking at these two glaciers are some of the fastest receding glaciers in the Northern Hemisphere. So there's a lot of recession and a lot of new rock coming out. Rock poem. Awed by the patterns, I say, I'd like to be here with a geologist. And you say, one was here once, an old guy who said, wow, this is some ugly rock. And I'm thinking, that is the last word I'd use to describe it. Ugly, he meant tortured. He knew the processes that led to these starburst scrolling fractures, white scribbles across gray, orange shimmering splashes undercut by green. He knew these color patterns evidenced a long mutilation of bedrock granite. But for me, sitting on the headland, it's the epitome of beauty, draws my gaze again and again. The lines are messages scrawled by giants. The earth is speaking to me in a language I do not yet understand.
Lovely. It's very descriptive.
Thanks.
That's what I like about all of your work. It brings forth an image that is easily sort of understood. And I find this book very approachable for poetry. A lot of times people are intimidated by poetry.
Right. I'm still intimidated by a lot of poetry that I read out there.
Yeah.
I think, a lot of us grew up thinking, I don't get poetry. I don't get it. And what I learned is that it's just finding the poet whose work speaks to you. So, some poetry is more accessible than others, I think. And I want mine to be, so I'm glad to hear that it is.
In this poem, it feels like to me you're conveying a language of rock. Like we have a language of glacier, like the language it speaks.
Yeah.
Is that accurate sort of feeling?
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that it feels that way to you because... a lot of times what I'm doing with my work, and these are my poetry as well as the heart of the sound, is I mostly want to get myself out of the way and try to let the place or the beings or the glaciers or the rock or the bears, whoever it is, speak. And that might sound a little crazy, but I think that some of my best writing has been when I feel like I'm just a translator or I'm just the conduit through which something is coming. It sounds a little mystical, but it kind of is. And that's what I mean to do. So I'm glad that that's coming through.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's something that we are learning more and more about all the time, like science, Western science. And
exactly.
Obviously, indigenous knowledge has been there for a long, long, long time. And
right.
We're maybe slowly catching up with it. Of our understanding of whether it's systems or individuals, an individual rock or glacier, how it all works together is incredible.
Right, yeah. Like what we've been learning about fungi, and what we've been learning about trees and communication and the senses of plants and the senses of animals. There's a new book, what's it called? It's just about the different senses that animals have that we don't have. In fact, one of my poems in there is about, it starts from this idea that it turns out birds can hear many more notes
right.
than we can.
Yeah.
So we're not even hearing everything. Even when our hearing is perfect, we're not hearing everything.
Explain that a little bit, because I read that poem and I was like, I understand it, but it's like they're actually tuning into the wavelength. Explain that concept a little bit more if you can.
Well, you know, I just know what I have read in science journals, and I'm not an acoustic scientist myself, so I'm not sure how much I can clarify it, except to say that somehow scientists have figured out that birds can hear different notes, and that is both it has something to do with the frequency.
Right. Yeah.
And so they can. So when you hear a bird song, when a bird is singing its song, there's more there than the human ear can detect. In the same way that dogs can smell more than we can. It's not just that their smell is stronger. They have more sense, you know, that they can smell. So their world is more a map of senses, of sense, rather than of sights, as it is with humans.
Yeah. Yeah, we are so very sight and cerebrally oriented that I think we miss a lot. One of my many moments in the sound that stands out to me was not that long ago. I was at the Derrickson Spit back in Port Nelly One, and it was in the morning. No one else was up yet, and I was sitting on the beach, and there's a marmot that lives or used to live at the end of the beach under a rock. And I've been at beach a lot, and I'd never seen the marmot.
I'd seen the tracks.
Huh. Yeah, right on the beach, and it's under this rock, and people sit on the rock. They have picnics, and there's a bonfire, and there's this marmot sitting there, and there was a black bear also up above on this little hillside, and I could just feel like they had this relationship. That we were transient in nature, like we came and went. Their little thing went in, saw the glacier, the ood and odd. Mm-hmm. But here are these two creatures that this was their home. Like they didn't move that far from this spot. Mm-hmm. And there's probably a bald eagle in there too, because there's been salmon run back in there. Mm-hmm. And so they all had this relationship, this little community with attention and probably no love, maybe, who knows, this happens everywhere in nature, that you know, we're sort of coming and going, like we're, especially us Western types, are always moving and not sitting still long enough to appreciate things.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of relationships going on out there, and when you say maybe not love, well, who knows? You know, I mean, I think there's a lot more cooperation in nature, and that's something else that science is uncovering, is that, for example, with what we're learning about trees, there's a lot more cooperation. It's not just competition.
Yeah.
So that Darwinian idea of, you know, survival of the fittest, which actually really Darwin had much more to say than just that, because he did speak about cooperation. It's just that social Darwinism latched onto the survival of the fittest phrase, and that's all we remember now. So I think there is a lot of cooperation going out there and on out there. And I think of, for example, Gordon's stories about wolves. One of them, he says, you know, sometimes they're hunting and sometimes they're not. And he had seen, you know, wolves just hanging out by the den, sleeping the afternoon away, and a moose walking right by them, and nobody stirred. They didn't, you know, it's not like every time they see a moose, they're going, I'm going to eat you.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes they're not.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of cooperation going on out there and a lot of community. Everything is so connected.
So much we don't know.
Yeah.
This is Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Tordap. I have Mary Beth Holloman in the studio with me talking about her new book, Tender Gravity. We'll take a short break and we'll be right back with Mary Beth.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tordak. I'm here with Mary Beth Holloman, talking about her Tender Gravity. We were talking earlier in the first half about wolves and Gordon Haber, and why don't we go into another reading? You want to introduce it?
Sure. This is a poem called Yesterday on the Familiar Trail, and it takes place some trails that I live near. Here in Anchorage, we have so many great trails. It was one spring, the trails were fairly empty. We were over there with our dogs, and we ran into a couple of wolves.
Oh, neat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yesterday on the familiar trail. A routine walk. You know the kind. Your mind is far away, and it's just your bones walking, marking the rhythm of heartbeat to footstep. It's always like this right before you see them. The ones who never take an absent-minded step. Staring at you with heads lowered, ears erect, paws spread wide, and hackles half-raised. Golden eyes deciding whether you're predator or prey. What other category do they need? What other thought? It's you, with your 1,001 concepts, who must step back toward that joy sap rising, step back into the only world that is.
Oh, lovely. So talk to us about that.
Wild beings are always in the present moment. They don't really waste time thinking about what happened last week or what somebody said or what you're supposed to get done tomorrow. And humans are always, we spend so much time in the past and in the future and so little time in the present. And for me, I get brought back into the present moment in a moment like that when I suddenly encounter a wild animal, and in this case, wolves, fairly close, just here in Anchorage, which was pretty surprising on so many levels. And they're just always in the present moment. And I think that that is such an important lesson for us. You know, it's a Buddhist, you know, the Buddhist saying, present moment, only moment, or as Thich Nhat Hanh put it, present moment, perfect moment. A lot of times when we get freaked out, it's because we're not in the present moment. You know, we're somewhere else. We're worrying about, what is that Wendell Berry line, one of his poems, when he wakes in the night worrying and he goes down to the pond where the wood drake rests on the water and he says, I come into the presence of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief.
Mm-hmm.
We spend a lot of time taxing our lives with forethought of grief. Things that haven't even happened. So there's just so much solace, so much joy to be gained from just being in the natural world around beings that are always in the present moment.
Let's talk about grief. It's apparent in this book that you've had some. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about that and mm-hmm. how it's influenced sure. your poetry?
Yeah, so my little brother, Tom, was murdered in 2008, and it came as a shock to everyone. It was an incredibly deep, terrible loss, and I had actually never lost anyone close to me except my grandparents up until then.
Mm.
And so, anyhow, during this falling apart period, I went to see my naturopath, Hope Wing, who sat down with me, gave me some rescue remedy, and then said, you need to go take some walks in nature. That's what grounds you. And I had literally forgotten that. I cannot believe that I did. But I think I thought about this a lot during the pandemic when people were so sideswiped with grief, left and right, and loss. And, you know, sometimes we do forget what grounds us when things throw us off balance. So anyhow, it was a good reminder that I do, that is where I get grounded, that is where I get back to center, and that is where I get clarity about what I can do in the moment, given the grief that's presented. And we all face grief in our lives at one point or another, at many points.
Yeah.
So the natural world is a great solace to me.
And you have a poem called Refugium about that.
Yeah, so, I do.
We could read it, or I just like this line here. You know, I want to stay on your sturdy shoulders and wait out the storm sure to come, the one we have set upon ourselves. That's about climate change. We apply to a lot of things.
Yeah, it's about climate chaos and biodiversity loss and all the losses that we're experiencing that human society has in large part created. I have a bumper sticker on my car that says, I'd rather be a coyote. People ask me what it means. There was a singer-songwriter named Katie Lee, who was one of the people that tried to stop the Glen Canyon Dam, and along with Edward Abbey and others. And that quote comes from her. She said, you know, all these people that want to just develop and ruin and flood all these beautiful places, I'd rather be a coyote. And so, yeah, sometimes I would.
Talk about dealing with loss. You said something earlier about pain, working through pain with pain or something like that.
It's a quote by Rumi. He says, the remedy for the pain is in the pain. And so when I feel the loss of my glaciers leaving, of the billions of birds that we've lost in North America, when I see the losses that are before us with climate chaos and extinctions and biodiversity loss, what helps me is to go out and be in it, you know, to go out and walk one of these familiar trails and watch the chickadees flitting from branch to branch and doing their thing, like living their day, and go down to the stream and see the salmon swimming up that stream, you know, doing their thing and just getting grounded again in the present moment. And that's the cure for the pain is in the pain. You know, you go back to that source that you know is also leaving for the cure.
Speaking of salmon, there's some pieces on salmon in here.
I think you have to, as an Alaska writer, you're required to write about salmon. I think it's a requirement.
And it's such a powerful, their lives are so short, and it's this amazing thing that happens that they, you know, find their way back and then reproduce and then die.
Yeah.
Is that, how's that influenced you? Have you looked at that? I know I look at it and immediately get philosophical when I see a salmon run, especially in this modern stage.
Yeah. Yeah, and all the other animals that they feed.
Yeah.
You know, and how their ocean lives are linked to our streams and our forests. Animals that eat the salmon and then carry the rest of the salmon up into the woods and it feeds the trees. I mean, they're just like this essential part of the fabric of the earth. And I think that they're just amazing. And I watch them and I think, first of all, how do they do that? Like, how do they find their natal stream again? And then how do they keep pushing? How do they go into fresh water again after being in salt water for so long? There's so much mystery there and so much beauty. And whenever I see them in a stream nearby every end of the summer, I'm just so thankful that they're back.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's an amazing thing. Speaking of refuge, obviously not everybody can go kayaking out in Prince William Sound. Well, I think everybody could, but you know, it's not within everybody's ability or even interest. Mm-hmm. But you also talk about gardening and dirt.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. You know, was it Emily Dickinson, the famous American poet, who didn't stray far from her little yard and wrote had incredible poetry, but incredible insights. You don't have to go very far. You don't need very much nature. There's a lot of great people writing about urban nature, you know, the tree that grows through the crack in the sidewalk, or the butterfly that somehow comes into the yard from who knows where. I think that there's, and a lot of my poems do, I focus on smaller life forms like the sphagnum moss or the sundew plant, which is an amazing little plant that most people don't even see because it's so tiny. So I think that you don't really have to go out into some grand landscape to have that same sense of awe and beauty and wonder.
Yeah. How about another poem?
Sure. Let's see.
And while you're looking, we'll say that we'll have a link on the Outdoor Explorer website to Mary Beth's work, and where you can find the book.
Yeah, so I'm going to read a poem called The Outer Coast, and this is one of many kayaking poems in here. This one takes place in the Kodiak Archipelago, a place that I had wanted to go to for probably 20 years before I finally got to go there. And I guess the other thing I'll say about it is that what I've found, and I'm sure that a lot of people have found this to be the case too, sometimes you can be in a place that you've never been before, but there's a sense of the familiar. I mean, and again, I think this goes back to some kind of larger memory at work, not just my own individual life for how many years I may have been on this planet, but something bigger going on.
Mm-hmm.
The Outer Coast. I have dreamed this, have dreamed long swells rocking, light swaying westward, round blue sea, meeting only lambent sky. Fine eelgrass ribboning green to otherwise blue. From where this longing for something beyond familiar? For floating far from ground, where surface yields to crusting humpback and spangles with puffin wing beats. Remote as stars glinting among undulations of kelp, this outer coast, and yet home to some primigenial memory of when I, like these moon jellies slipping by, spent days aimlessly aimed for what I could not yet see.
Hmm. Yeah, the moon jellies.
Hmm.
And one thing I heard you say, which has really helped me digest poetry, believe it or not, after all these years of trying to read it, is to read things more than once.
Yes.
You want to talk about that?
Yes. Poetry especially, read it more than once, because it's so compressed. There's so much going on in those few lines and in those few images. And there can be more layers each time you read it. And I have books that I go back to year after year after year and read again. You know, Walt Whitman's Song of Myself is a good example. I mean, I think I should read that every year. I find something different because I'm a different person the next time I read it.
Yeah.
So I think it's not only what's there, but also who you are when you're reading it. But yes, reading it a couple times and then also just looking for a poet whose work speaks to you, because there's so much different kinds of poetry out there. And there are poets that didn't used to speak to me and now they do. And it's probably because I'm different.
Mm-hmm. So let's take this Outer Coast that you just read. When I read it, I clue in on, for some, the jellyfish mm-hmm. and the idea of them drifting aimlessly, but not really aimlessly. And what would be a lesson? You know, what inspired that a little bit? And what's the lesson that you would take from a jellyfish aimlessly
yeah.
wandering? I don't think they're aimless, but yeah.
Yeah, it looks aimless to us.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, because we're always so purposeful. You know, we're always moving from point A to point B, you know. And that's one of the things that I love about wilderness adventures is that you're not, you know, you're kind of, you have sort of a plan, but there's all kinds of other things that get in the way, mainly weather. And so you can't, you have to loosen the grip a little bit on your plans than on that focus on the future. And so when I look at jellyfish and I think, you know, yes, they're living their lives and this is all they know. Like, this is how they move around. They're so dependent on currents. And so they're so connected to their world. You know, they can't detach from it and get where they need to go or get the food they need to get or stay safe. They have to just be flowing with it all the time. And so mm-hmm. it's that idea of like flowing with what is going on, which is hard for us humans because we have so many ideas about how things should be. But then they just are the way they are. And we have to figure out how to navigate that.
Yeah.
You know? And jellyfish are very good. They just, things are the way they are and they navigate it.
This is Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Tordak. I'm here with Mary Beth Holland and talking about a new book, Tender Gravity. Tell us about the title. It's a lovely title.
Thank you.
Gravity is always with us.
Yeah. Yeah. So the title comes from the first poem in the book. And in choosing it, I was thinking about a couple things. One, I was thinking about how gravity holds us here on this earth and how glad I am that it does, because I love being on this planet. It's such an incredible home we have. And I feel that it holds us, that it's more of a holding. And so it's a tenderness because it's holding us here. And it's, you know, that if we think about it, there's so much to be grateful for, and that we have air that we can breathe and water that we can drink and sustenance all around us, not to mention all the just plain beauty that's out there. So that's mainly the idea behind the book, is that fortunate sense of being able to be alive on this planet.
Yeah. And taking care of the planet, you've been a very strong advocate in many different, I think we sort of on this loosely, a group called Friends of Two Head State Park.
Yes.
And then you helped us get the Prince William Sound Stewardship Foundation going.
Right.
And talk about that. And obviously you have a lot of motivation, but you know, why is that important to you? Just sort of an obvious answer, but in a deeper sense, in the sort of light of what could be considered, you know, we're not doing a great job with climate change. We're not,
right.
You know, a lot of sort of depressing news in times of the way the Earth's headed. What keeps you motivated to be writing and advocating and being involved?
Just being out in it, really, is the short answer. That's what keeps me motivated. I mean, it's easy to fall into despair. Like I mentioned that petition earlier, it's like, just give up then, you know, at what point?
Yeah.
But why give up? As long as I'm here, why would I give up? You know, never give up, never surrender, as they said in Galaxy Quest. And I think that, you know, in terms of advocacy, I look for where I can be of use, where I can make a difference. And sometimes it works. Most of the time it doesn't, but you keep trying anyhow. And I try to work on many levels. I do consider my writing advocacy work in itself. And then I try to work on, you know, local levels like Friends of Chugach State Park, the trails that I walk, and then how to work on bigger things like climate chaos. And a lot of that, I try to support groups like the Sunrise Movement, which is a youth movement in this country that are trying to create change. And so sometimes if it's around election time, I'm doing a lot of letter writing to voters. It depends on what's going on, but there's always something that can be done, and always looking at what I'm going to quote a philosopher, Friedrich Buechner, who said, "Your calling," well, this is loosely quoting, I may be a little off, "your calling is at the intersection of the world's great need and your great gladness."
Hmm.
And I really like that quote, because I think if we push ourselves to do advocacy work that we don't enjoy at all, then we're going to burn out. But there must be something we like about it. Sometimes it's just the people we get to work with, you know, like our Friends of Chugach State Park group. You know, we like each other. We're friends, and we enjoy this sense of tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And so there has to be something that brings you gladness about it in order for you to stay in the fight. Because it's a long haul.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the environmental issues we face, like the Arctic Refuge, the only way it ever goes away is if we lose and they develop it. As long as it's not developed, it's at risk and we have to keep fighting. That's just the deal.
Yeah, yeah. And the idea of incremental change, particularly in a place like Prince William Sound that's relatively accessible, is I find talking to people, especially when they go out for the first time, they think, rightly so, it's an amazing place, it's beautiful, there's fish jumping and birds flying overhead and harbor seals and sea otters, and it's so hard to convey the idea that it isn't what it used to be. And we don't even know what it used to be, really. Like,
right.
What was it used to be, you know, 500 years ago? We don't know that. And So what did you say to, you talked about the Sunrise Movement and youth, like, what's your message to them, like, to stay hopeful and how to stay hopeful?
Well, I think one message that we elders can convey is we've got your back, you know, like, we're here. And if you want advice, you want support, we're here. And to let them speak and, you know, let them feel their power and let them feel empowered. As I did when I was, you know, a college student, you know, I was up there marching on Washington against no nukes. You know? Yeah. I'm dating myself, but yeah, you know, so I think it's important to just to support each other. And it's what Joanna Macy says, link arms. I think there's a lot of gladness in that. And yeah, Prince William Sound has changed so much. It's it brings up this idea of that shifting baseline. That when you experience a place, like the first time I experienced Prince William Sound was in the, you know, a few years before the oil spill, so the mid-80s. And so to me, that's the ideal Prince William Sound. And it's not that anymore. But there's still so much there that's so incredible, and there's so much to work to protect. So we just go from there, remember that our baselines will shift, you know, and recall what we can about what it used to be, so we can try to protect as much as possible.
Yeah. I like Prince of Sound. It's a great example of a saying I heard, that all land is indigenous land because it all has a human history, and that the sound in particular is a place that people have been at for, you know, probably around 5,000 years. And
right.
And our perspective, a lot of us are come out of the 60s and 70s, that it was sort of this empty place because, you know, there was the earthquake, the tsunami, various economic things were going on at the time. And, you know, people moved out of the sound where it used to be very inhabited.
Right.
And now, so it's constantly evolving.
Right, it is constantly evolving. Of course, they were living in the sound much differently than people are now, you know, no motors, for example. And so it's a different level of use, I guess, and in terms of being a more harmonious, sustainable use. So that's what we want. We want it to be a harmonious, sustainable use where all the other critters that live there get to continue on with their lives too. The marmot and the bear get to continue on with their lives there. And so how do we do that? And I think that there's a lot of indigenous knowledge that we have yet to draw from that we need to keep looking at.
And I think that we're getting close to our end of our time with you. So we want to, I'd like to hear another reading, and one of those items out there are whales. But before I do that, I just want to go through, for the readers to know what's in this book. It's really amazing. You have birds, you have trees, you have asteroids,
yeah.
You have moss. We talked about wolves, rocks. I love the rock poems. You have Gravity, the name of the book, Tender Gravity. We talked about the sundew plant. Lots about place. Lots about some about your brother and moss from Siberia. I think maybe Africa is in here. Did I cut something from Africa? Or was I...
Well, sure, a little bit. There's a mention of a cheetah. Yes,
okay, that's it.
That one last long poem that strings together so many moments.
One I really liked was about a Willy Wall, which I read thinking, oh, this is about wind. And I don't think it was about wind. I think it was about light, maybe. Is that correct?
So, yeah. It's those lakes.
Lakes, yeah.
Yeah, the Willy Wall lakes.
Yeah, and up in the Chugach.
Yeah.
Ice skating and bringing back joy through an activity.
Yeah, and frogs.
And frogs. Yeah, so it's got something for everybody. I love the one about not the moon. Idea of us, our perspective of, I think that sums up a lot of this book, is that the world doesn't really revolve around us.
Yeah.
It's a different perspective. Well, the moon doesn't rise. We're just spinning underneath it.
Yeah. I know, yeah. And it's really mind-blowing to try to think about that when you're sitting there watching the moon rise. It's not the moon rising. It's the earth turning.
Yeah.
And gravity's holding us on, you know. Just thanks. Yeah, the poems are mostly set in Alaska, but also other places I've been, like you mentioned. And there's some Hawaii poems in there. There's one at the end where I got to go to Antarctica, the remembered earth.
Right.
Lots of other beings speaking, hopefully.
Yeah. Do you want to read about another one for us?
Yeah, which one are you thinking?
Well, we talked about whales.
Got a short whale one. You want that
one? Let's try that
one. Sure. Okay. Good. Now, this is in Prince William Sound, only fitting. Mm-hmm. Whales at night. They come after the day's fishing fleet has gone to anchor. Awaken us with a sigh that sounds human, but is whale breath. The long exhale after a deep dive, sprays dappling concentric rings left by their arcs into air on an otherwise silent and glassy sea.
Hmm. Nice. I think that when we talk about their book and their writing, and it's so descriptive that it does capture about a lot of things. They're obviously love of place, but you've provided even for people who might not go and not have the same experiences, an image that can really create a bond to a place, and I guess what I'm getting at is that writing and your writing. And other forms of art are a reason almost in themselves to advocate for place.
Yes.
You know, because it's a tangible thing that is brings us joy in itself, right?
Yes. So, yeah. Yes, it brings us a sense of that place. It's that place speaking, those beings speaking. And so, you know, I don't have to, for example, go to the Arctic Refuge in order to care about it, because humans have written and created art about it, and in that way, I get a sense of what it must be, and therefore I want to protect it. And so I think that that is an important function of writing and art, is to connect us to this greater planet, because no way can any one human visit everywhere on the planet. You just can't. It's too big.
And it inspires such great work. It inspires art. It inspires writing. It inspires that in itself. It's just another reason to care for and you know, all the many of the great art and
all of our art and all of our science, everything that we have and think of and can imagine, comes from this earth. Where else would it come from? You know, it didn't just arise out of the human mind from nothingness.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's all connected. So, yeah.
Thank you very much for being on the show, Mary Beth. So where can people find the book?
You can order it online from bookshop, from the publisher, from Barnes & Noble, from Amazon. You can get it in here in Anchorage. It's at the Writer's Block. I think some other local bookstores, any of your local bookstores can order it. So it's pretty widely available.
Yeah. And we'll have links on the Outdoor Explorer website to some of those places. So again, thank you very much for being with Mary Beth Holloman. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. This has been great fun.
Thanks to my guest, Mary Beth Holloman, author of Tender Gravity. You can find links to her website on the Outdoor Explorer webpage at alaskapublic.org. A special thanks to our producer, Eric Bork. This is your host, Paul Tordock, and from all the hosts at Outdoor Explorer, thanks for listening, support our local writers, and we'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.